Today on Against the Grain, the drive to put prices on everything to be sold is a basic feature of capitalism. Political theorist Alyssa Battistoni asks, then why capitalism has failed at putting a price on so much of nature, which she regards as central to understanding capitalism's destruction of the natural world. She also argues that the relationship that capitalism forces us to have with the rest of nature makes us less free as human beings. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Capitalism damages the natural world, such as the air we breathe, without paying for it, in effect, for free. There are some who argue that a price can and should be calculated for such so-called externalities, while others on the left are appalled by the idea of putting a price on a polar bear or clean water. But Alyssa Battistoni asked a more fundamental question in her book, Free Gifts, Capitalism and the Politics of Nature. Why hasn't capitalism managed to put a price on everything? She's assistant professor of political science at Barnard College. Alyssa, conventional economics regards the ecological crisis, such as using rivers as a sink to dump industrial chemicals into, or using our air as a place to release toxic fumes into, or carbon emissions, as fundamentally a failure in putting prices on nature, of considering them as free gifts. Can you explain that logic from the perspective of mainstream economics?
The way we've come to think about most notably climate change, but I think a number of other environmental and ecological problems, is that basically they are sort of these material effects or sort of material processes that aren't being reflected in prices. And so they end up not being reflected in market decisions. So, the kind of famous description of climate change and the Economics of Climate Change report by Nicholas Stern is that it's a market failure, the largest market failure the world has seen. And that basically, like, carbon emissions aren't being factored into the cost of goods. And so they're being produced, overproduced, because no one's getting a sort of price signal that this is, that these are a problem. And there's so many other sort of features of our world that are like that. So carbon emissions are the most obvious, but you'll see people talk about things like the economic invisibility of nature more broadly, the sort of failure to value the Amazon, or various kinds of biodiversity, or the roles that ecosystems have in doing things like filtering water or absorbing storm surge, or many, many other things. And for a system where sort of the only way for things to count or to sort of register is through the mechanism of price, it really is a big problem that a lot of these elements of the natural world aren't priced and sort of don't show up in the form of price.
But isn't that just kind of weird? Isn't, putting prices on things a hallmark of capitalism? And if that's the case, how could parts of nature be left out? Doesn't that appear to run against the nature of the system?
Yeah, so this is sort of the problem that I think is really interesting. This has been repeatedly identified as sort of the cause of all these environmental problems in mainstream economics, that these things are either negative or positive externalities, but all these elements of the natural world are not priced and aren't showing up, and that's a problem. But it does seem really counterintuitive, because the thing we all think we know about capitalism is that it just commodifies everything, right? It puts a price on everything. The march of commodification is constantly continuing. And in fact, on the left, I think a lot of the worries about ecological economics or the way to deal with these things has been concerned with precisely the prospect that nature might be priced and sort of brought into the market. There's been a lot of critiques of the possibility that, as some economists have proposed, to put a price on nature to save it, the sort of effort to internalize the externalities, as it were. But in fact, that really hasn't happened very much, and I think that's what points to the sort of deeper problem in capitalism, of the sort of failure of capitalism more broadly to value nature, the real difficulty that often comes up in valuing nature, that it's not just a sort of marginal problem, that actually there is a sort of foundational tendency in capitalism to treat nature as a free gift that's actually, I think, quite difficult to rectify, and that has a lot of implications for how we think about what capitalism is and does.
And we'll, of course, talk about that as we go during this hour. But I guess I should just ask you right at this point, what do we mean, or what should we mean, when we talk about nature, often seen as something formerly pristine that we have despoiled?
It's a great question. It's a tough question. You know, as Raymond Williams famously said, nature is the most complex word in the language. And there are a lot of ways to think about nature, and including sort of the kinds of cultural meaning and significance we attribute to it. In the book, I try to mostly talk about nature as in kind of minimal terms, as sort of the biophysical world, which includes human beings, and sort of, you know, that we are continuous with nature, or part of nature. So thinking about it as, yeah, material reality in some sense. And then there are times and places where I try to talk about nature as sort of in terms of non-human nature, and the distinction that I think, the particular form of a distinction that I think capitalism draws between human beings and the rest of the more than human world. So those are the two main senses that I try to think about what nature is, although there are a lot of, I actually want to be a little critical of some of the ways that we think about, nature is pristine, or kind of have a cultural imagination of what nature is that might be quite different.
Well, let's step back and look at some of the history that got us to the place that we are now. How did classical political economists understand the question of nature and the idea of something that is, in effect, a gift?
You know, we have all these conversations today about climate change and externality and so on, and the ecosystems that aren't valued, but these kinds of conversations go back much farther. So you can see, if you read the classical political economists who are writing in the 18th and 19th centuries and sort of trying to diagnose what's going on as they watch the rise of capitalism, more or less, you know, it's really striking that they talk, I think, pretty frequently about the gifts of nature, the natural agents that are giving gratuitously to production, the role of all these sort of natural agents in production, like sheep organs and soil fertility and wind that's driving mills and sails, all of these different kinds of physical properties of the world, they talk about as gifts of nature that are giving freely to production. And they're sort of often really amazed. It's this sort of tenor of gratitude and appreciation of these sort of tremendous powers of nature that are giving for free to production. So you see the sort of recognition of both the physical, you know, kind of significance of nature, and usually for them it's a good thing. It's sort of not like, look at the more negative effects or the ways that we're degrading the gifts of nature. They're often celebrating them in a sense, but they also tend to be, I think, a bit naive about what's happening with the gifts of nature. And that's where Marx's critique of them comes in.
Yeah, so tell us about that. How did Marx understand the gifts of nature within the larger framework of the capitalist system?
Marx is critical of the classical political economists in the way that he's critical of them on many fronts. He thinks that they are not adequately attentive to the ways that capitalism is a sort of specific historical system. You know, they're describing something like production in general as if that's just kind of how economies and production and labor and all of these things work under any system, as if it's a sort of natural system in some way. And he wants to say, no, these things are really distinctive to capitalism as a system organized by class and by these market relations and all of these specific features. And so he says that they've misunderstood something important about wealth, that they're sort of acting as if these natural agents, these sort of physical elements, are just generating wealth on their own, as if wealth is almost just like emerging from the soil, particularly people like the physiocrats who do think that all wealth comes from nature. And Marx is basically like, well, wealth isn't, you know, what we think of as wealth as a material wealth isn't what capitalism designates as value. These are different things, and we have to focus on the latter and what is wealth under capitalism. And he has this brief comment on the free gift of nature. He says, you know, that basically nature gives to capitalists alone in a capitalist system, that it's the capitalists, the people who own the means of production, who are benefiting from all of these natural agents and the sort of productivity gains they enable and the various kinds of production that they make possible. They're the ones who are reaping the spoils and capturing the wealth. So we have to sort of, you know, have a more critical perspective both on what wealth is and who's benefiting from it. But it's a really, he sort of doesn't say very much more about the free gift of nature. And I think that's a shame, because it's a really interesting and strange concept, actually. The idea of the free gift is actually, I think, pretty weird when you think about it, because gifts are sort of definitionally free. It seems a sort of like a redundant term. It's a gift is something you don't buy or sell. It's something that you usually get through some other kind of interaction or relationship. So it seems kind of redundant, but on the other hand, it can seem kind of oxymoronic, because usually, you know, there's a longstanding way of thinking about the gift as something that you have to reciprocate. It's something that incurs obligations. It requires some kind of return of the gift. It's a relationship of reciprocity. And so a free gift seems to be sort of counter to the very idea of the gift. And so for me, I think this is why we need to think about the free gift and the free gift of nature as a sort of kind of relationship to nature that's specific to capitalism, specific to a system that is defined by and sort of organized around the commodity. And the commodity is something that is, you know, valued in terms of price, exchange value, the sort of monetary form of value from which the free gifts of nature are excluded.
Well, I wonder if you could talk more about that. And although I realize it's a tall order to explain, or at least simply, I wonder if, since this has bearing here, you could lay out for us how Marx understood use value and exchange value.
Yeah, absolutely. So for Marx, the commodity is what he calls the elementary form of capitalism. And that's really where Capital, the book, starts, and what Capital is mostly about is trying to understand this sort of form of through which we relate to one another and to sort of the stuff of the world in capitalist societies. And he says that the commodity is defined by, it has like a dual character. It's defined by these sort of two elements of use value and exchange value. And he sometimes talks about this in terms of natural form and social form, or sort of content and form. But use value is pretty straightforward in some ways. So it's what it sounds like. It's what we would use something for. It's kind of a material and qualitative set of features. So if you thought about a table, for instance, the use value might be in how sturdy the table is. You might think about what kind of wood it's made out of, the quality of the wood, if it looks nice, if it's sort of big enough to use for a dinner party, or if it's, you know, something you might use for a desk. You know, what are these sort of qualities it has, and what are their sort of material significance and usefulness to you. And usefulness can encompass a lot of things. It can be something like, is it beautiful? It can be, you know, is it kind of utilitarian and a more just, it can bear a lot of weight. It's a pretty expansive category, but that's kind of the realm of things we're thinking about. But then exchange value, you know, Marx says, well, this doesn't really have any real bearing on the exchange value, because exchange value doesn't sort of map clearly onto use value. Exchange value is this quantitative form of value, and it is, you know, again, sort of straightforward, like what can you get for it? What is its price? In other words, price is sort of the, you know, the form of exchange value, and how much money can you get for it? And, you know, what other kinds of things can you exchange it for? And you might be able to exchange the table for something really that's like qualitatively totally different. You know, the one table might be worth like five pairs of shoes or coats of linen, or, you know, Marx is all different examples. And so there's a lot of different, there's a sort of quantitative element of exchange that usually we, you know, end up using money to sort of reflect or to make those kinds of trades. But, you know, Mark says these aren't really correlated. They're not, usefulness isn't sort of the same thing at all. And in fact, the exchange value of something, its price, really doesn't have very much to do with its qualities. And so there's a divergence there between use and exchange value, even as they're always kind of have to, you know, a commodity always have to have both of these things.
Right. So something could be incredibly useful and sell for very little, or the opposite. I'm speaking with political theorist Alyssa Battistoni, author of Free Gifts, Capitalism and the Politics of Nature. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain. So how do we see the operation of the gift of nature when we're thinking of something that is in many ways the ultimate symbol of capitalism, which is industrial production?
Yes, so industrial production is usually not where we go to think about nature. It is sort of a, you know, seen as sort of the heart of capitalism, but also in some ways, you know, where nature goes to die or something like that. Kind of usually we think about nature as kind of being, you know, Nancy Fraser says, beyond the hidden abode of production, sort of in a different realm in some way. But I think that there's that we can find the gifts of nature in sort of the heart of production itself, and in a couple of different places. And I think about the free gifts of nature and production in the form of sort of the way the natural forces are channeled through things like machinery, but just through the general kinds of these non-human elements of production that are basically recombinations of natural elements that are then kind of performing work in the process, that are sort of, in some cases, generating entirely new material capabilities. And again, that the kind of new material phenomena that are that result from, you know, figuring out new kinds of technologies that are, again, just recombining these forces of nature to do new things, and the ways that those are captured by capitalists. But Marx describes human labor and the cooperative power of human labor as a free gift of nature. And that, I think, is another really important one. So basically, this is the way that human laborers, you know, when people work together, they're sort of more than the sum of their parts. They can do things that no individual worker could do. You can kind of work across time and space in different ways. You can coordinate and cooperate in ways that make possible entirely novel kinds of production. And for Marx, this is a, you know, he describes this as a free gift that's kind of resulting from like human capacities. Something about human beings and what we're able to do, almost on the level of something like species being. And so that is, you know, another element where I think we can think about, if we think of human beings as, you know, being in some ways continuous with the non-human world, that these features of human life in general, sort of ability to coordinate and cooperate and design, you know, the ways to organize ourselves to make, you know, the things we need, end up producing these, you know, kinds of generating, you know, productivity and wealth that tend to be captured by, again, by capital in a capitalist system. So I try to think about both these sorts of like elements of, you know, the non-human, elements of non-human nature as they appear in production, thinking about, you know, industrial machinery, but also the ways that we've made a lot of living elements into effectively machinery from, you know, the sort of factories in the fields of agriculture, or the re-engineering of, you know, livestock and plants and various things to kind of to sort of act almost as if they are machines. So I try to think about how, you know, all of these sorts of elements of production have been reorganized by capitalism to sort of generate more gifts, but then also how the interaction between the non-human world and human laborers and in production is you know, organized to kind of make to generate even more of the gifts of human labor, and how those things go together.
And not to jump too far ahead in our discussion, but isn't that second one the way that capitalism takes advantage of the gift of human cooperation and creativity, and the way that we are more creative when we come together socially than any of us could be in isolation, that contains within it a kernel of possibility for a society without capitalism.
Yeah, absolutely. That I think this is one of the things that I think Marx has always seen or always saw in capitalism, and that many socialists since have seen it in capitalism, that it does sort of often develop these new human and non-human capacities, or sort of reorganizes elements of our lives together in ways that show other things that are possible, even as they're done under, you know, that kind of coordination, you know, within like an assembly line or something, is usually done under conditions of domination, and you know, is often, you know, kind of produces degraded forms of work and so on, but also suggests ways that you know, we might sort of unleash other gifts of cooperation, both amongst humans, but I think also between human beings and the more than human world. And so that there are these sorts of gifts that I think are unlocked by the organization of human and non-humans together, that are, yeah, organized one way under capitalism, but also could be organized very differently, in a way that I think might be more liberated and liberatory.
Moving from now away from the anti-capitalist critique and understanding of Marx to mainstream capitalist economics, where did the idea of an externality come from? That is a term that often gets used to explain how a process of production might go and harm living creatures, human, non-human, outside the narrow understanding of that production process.
Yeah, the history of the externality is, I think, really interesting. Again, we know it today often through something like climate change as an externality. But it originates with sort of the theorization of the externality first develops in the early 20th century with this British economist Arthur Pigou, who is, you know, living and writing in London, and in the midst of like a, you know, time of pretty intense urban pollution, and he writes about this phenomenon of what he calls the external effects of production that aren't captured in price. And his classic example is a smoky chimney. He says, you know, if there's a factory with a smoky chimney, it imposes all these costs on the community more broadly, in things like, you know, he talks about injuries to buildings and vegetables, which is a great phrase, and, you know, making people's laundry dirty, you know, making the air worse to breathe. There's, you know, many effects that he describes, kind of limiting the daylight, all of these kinds of things. But they are, you know, the factory owner doesn't have to pay for any of those costs. And some of them are kind of literal costs, like you have to get your laundry done more often and that makes it more expensive for everyone else. Some of them are kind of more physical costs, like to health or something like that. But he says, you know, the factory owner doesn't have to pay for any of these. And so they are going to overproduce that kind of pollution because there's no, you know, there's no reason for them not to. And so his recommendation, you know, he's a welfare economist, so he's concerned with achieving, you know, the social welfare, and that's his priority. And he sees these external effects. He describes them as violent paradoxes, where you know, sort of the gains to private individuals diverge from what's good for society as a whole. And, you know, this is a place where it seems like, you know, kind of market exchange isn't actually producing sort of the best of all worlds for everyone. And so he thinks that the state is justified in intervening to tax the factory owner, to like assess kind of what's the basic cost that you're putting on the community, and to make them pay for it. And that's kind of the major way that people think about the externality for 40 years or so. But for the most of that time, economists are not that interested in it. They think it's kind of this like marginal problem. It's not a very big deal. It's pretty easy to fix and so on. And then in, you know, the sort of post-war boom period, that starts to change. You know, there are a lot more pollution problems. people start to become more worried about the, you know, industrial pollution and the effects of it on, you know, on human health and society and on the environment. It becomes like a mass political issue in a lot of places. And suddenly it seems like these sort of external effects are just everywhere. Like they actually are quite a significant problem. And that is actually worrisome to a lot of kind of, you know, neoliberal thinkers who are then emerging and developing, you know, their work. People like Milton Friedman are sort of concerned that the externality is everywhere, and it sort of seems to license like unlimited state intervention because you can find so many of these effects. But they there's a sort of counter an attack on Pigou by an economist named Ronald Coase, who says, well, we shouldn't think of this as the factory owner just imposing costs on everyone else. That's kind of just like already moralizing this problem. What's actually happening is a reciprocal problem. The factory owner, you know, the people who live near the factory are also to blame, because if, you know, if they didn't live there, it wouldn't really be a problem. So why should, you know, why should the factory owner have to stop pumping smoke out of the chimney? Why shouldn't the people who live near the factory pay the factory owner to stop? You know, why do we sort of assume that there's a sort of a one-way solution to this problem? And he proposes making pollution into a property right, and or like giving people property rights in pollution and sort of letting them work it out for themselves. So, you know, if you want the factory owner to stop polluting, you can pay them to do so, or maybe the factory owner can decide to pay the community to like let him pollute, but they can kind of just work it out in the market the way they might work any other thing out. And so those are kind of the two ways that I think mainstream economics have approached problems like climate change. So either through the kind of Pigouvian move, which is to something like a carbon tax, or, you know, Coase's proposal is the idea behind something like carbon markets.
Right. And yet, at this point, with those sort of vying approaches, is there a general sense within mainstream economics that this is a conundrum that needs more theorization or something, because it seems to still elude being redressed?
I think in mainstream economics, there's a sense that the theories are right, and there's just not enough, you know, what's often described as political will to address the problem or to impose one of them. You know, I think most economists think that these are pretty straightforward solutions to the problem. But what I think we need to do is to think about the problem of, you know, what Coase calls social cost a little bit more politically in itself, not just think of sort of the political will as something that you generate from the outside and then impose like the cost or whatever. Because I think, you know, Coase gets something right, I think, in saying that it is this reciprocal thing, that there's this relationship in the generation of social cost between the kind of person, you know, the factory owner who's producing the smoke in the community that lives nearby. But I think it's something more, I think of it as something more like class struggle than just kind of an equal relationship between parties. It's not just like the community and the factory owner on equal terms. I think this is a problem where, you know, you have owners of the means of production and owner, you know, factory owners or whatever, who are able to just produce in ways that are, you know, whether it's producing toxic smoke or other kinds of harmful byproducts of production, you know, whether that be something like chemicals dumped into a river or carbon dioxide dumped into the atmosphere. And the default is that they're able to do that for free, that they're able to sort of treat the rest of the world as sort of a free dumping ground. And that is very difficult. You know, other people don't have a lot of power to stop them. So there's a way in which they're sort of making use of all of our other people's bodies, other people's sort of physical health and capacities and ecological capacities without coming to any agreement about that, without, you know, paying anyone for it. So, you know, if you think about a traditional labor relationship, if you want somebody to come work in your factory, you have to like negotiate a wage with them and pay them for the use of their time and for the use of like, you know, their body in that time. You tell them what you're going to do. You want them to, you know, stand at this machine, or you are like sweeping the floor, you know, whatever your job is for this amount of time. But when it comes to something like pollution, it's just, you know, people who are near the factory are just they're being subjected to these the sort of process of production, to the stuff that's coming out of it. But nobody has asked them, nobody has negotiated with them, nobody has sort of paid them for the use of their lungs or whatever it may be in that time. So I think we need to think about that as something more akin to the forms of class power that we would look for and see in the workplace, but to see how those extend sort of beyond the bounds of the workplace and into the areas where, production is sort of spilling out into the world beyond, and kind of bring that same lens to it, and then think about, well, how might we, kind of collectively organize the people who are being subjected to that against the source of those harms, and kind of treat that as more of a struggle than just kind of like a technocratic problem for economists to solve.
I'm speaking with Alyssa Battistoni about her book, Free Gifts, Capitalism and the Politics of Nature. She's assistant professor of political science at Barnard College. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain. Well, as you just indicated, nature doesn't get compensated for the harms that it receives, if we can refer to this thing as nature. There's no wage for it. And as Marxist feminists have explored for decades, there's also forms of human labor that are produced without payment, such as work often by women in the household. I wonder if you could talk about how such unpaid, unwaged work benefits the capitalist system and how you understand it within this larger discussion of the gift of nature to the capitalist system.
Yeah, the book is really informed by, in general, I think a lot of my work is informed by thinking about the critiques that Marxist feminists have made of unwaged reproductive and household and domestic work, and trying to sort of think about, why there's this parallel between the sort of gifts of, the work of nature, as we might call it, and these kinds of human labor that are unwaged and often or underwaged often. And so, there's a chapter that's trying to think through, like, why do some kinds of human labor tend to take the form of the free gift? Why do they seem to be free gifts of nature? And trying to, understand that a little bit more. And what I try to do there, I think the way that a lot of Marxist feminist thought has understood that relationship is as resulting from a process of naturalization, that, quote unquote, women's work has been naturalized. It's been treated as part of nature. It's been sort of seen as part of nature, and therefore something that can be taken for free. It's part of sort of emanating from women's sort of nature. It's just part of who women are and what they do. And that this is sort of an ideological mystification of what's actually work. So housework is treated as nature rather than work, and that's why it hasn't been waged. And I think a lot of these critiques are really powerful, but I think that there are a couple of problems. And one is that they kind of don't ask this question, well, why is nature itself taken for free? Why can we just, when you say something is nature and not work, how come it then becomes freely available? And that's kind of, the broader problem of the book. But then, there's also this question, I think, of how is it that capital is able to kind of make us all see these kinds of labor in a certain way? Can we really give ideology so much power that we've all kind of just come to think about this work as being natural and not real labor? And so we haven't kind of been paying for it accordingly. And if that's the case, why haven't so many more kinds of labor been, mystified in that way? So I try to look at actually the sort of physical processes of what we call reproductive labor, and really kind of get into the, what is the labor process of reproductive labor? Like, what does it look like in a kind of concrete and material sense? And how might we then understand why this kind of work is less likely to be waged? And I think one of the things that stands out when you see that is, what is the work of reproducing human life? Like, that basically is sort of the question of reproductive labor. And I think when we look at it from that angle, we can see actually a lot of continuities between, kind of human reproductive labor and other kinds of labor in and on the natural world. So similarities to sectors like agriculture, where you have these sorts of rhythms and patterns of biophysical processes that don't kind of map on to the kinds of time that capital wants to operate on. So instead of having kind of like 24-hour production on this very kind of like rationalized schedule, where you're, you know, kind of always working and always, you know, producing stuff, and it's very like regular and steady, and kind of you can speed it up perpetually. All of these things that we think about when we think about industrial production, you know, there are a lot of sectors where natural processes interrupt those kinds of like that kind of drive towards ever smoother and faster production, where you have to, you know, wait for seeds to grow or for a tree to mature or something like that. And there's similar things that I think come up when we look at the reproduction of human life and labor power, where, you know, if you are thinking about care work, for instance, the person's body who you're caring for is operating on its own timeline. You know, somebody who's sick might not need attention all the time, but, you know, maybe something happens and they need you know, intensive care at one, at, you know, in one moment, and they don't at another. So you have to have a lot of, it's very labor intensive. People have to be available all the time, because they also childcare, you know, kind of keeping a small child who kind of can't fend for themselves alive requires, you know, a lot of labor and just kind of constant availability to sort of deal with the things that they might need at any given moment. And so these end up being very labor intensive processes. They're not that kind of hyper productive mode that we see in industrial sectors. They don't often have very good returns on investment. So, you know, capitalists often decide, well, this isn't worth investing in, this isn't sort of worth making into a sort of sector of accumulation. And so what I see it as is these kinds of labor are, I describe them as abdicated. You know, capital strategically abdicates some sectors and just says, like, this is, you know, again, this is like a set of activities that are not really worth investing in and commodifying and making, trying to make productive in this way. I'm just going to let people take care of them for themselves. You know, you figure out, you know, the worker supposed to show up at work, but then when they're off the clock, they figure out how to reproduce themselves in their own time. And however that is, you know, is kind of up to them. And so I think these kinds of labor end up being ones that the kinds of labor that remain unwaged are the ones that just like haven't been pulled out of the household and made into these more productive sites. And, you know, if we look at the history of what we call domestic or reproductive labor, a lot of things used to be done in the household that aren't anymore. So you could think of like not only a lot of the ways that like the service economy has replaced a lot of household work in the past, you know, few decades, but, you know, people used to churn butter at home and now you buy it at the store. So there's a lot of things that actually have made that shift from the home to the kind of industrial sector. But the ones that haven't, I think, are these ones that are very difficult to overcome, you know, that are very difficult to rationalize because in large part of some of these physical processes of the demands of reproducing human life and human bodies.
So how do you then assess those? You know, obviously there's not the compensation of a wage, but in thinking about the work, is the fact that they're not commodified or are not waged, does that have especially negative consequences for the work? Is it a realm of more freedom or neither?
Yeah, this is a great question, because I think, you know, it's hard to think about work that isn't waged sometimes. And I think there are sometimes people treat work that isn't waged as being, I think people can, sometimes it can be romanticized a bit, that it somehow are like escaped commodification, or there's something about this work that is resistant to commodification in almost like a moral sense. And I think there are things that are resistant about it, again, in almost a very physical sense, but I don't think that necessarily makes those kinds of work any better or worse than other kinds of work. I do think there's often more autonomy exerted over them. You know, the kinds of work you do at home, or at least the kinds of of non-autonomy or the kinds of unfreedom that are experienced in them usually look different than they do in a formal workplace. So, you know, you don't have a boss sort of telling you how to do your housework, but, you know, maybe it ends up being like, a family member, and I think usually like husband or father, kind of patriarchal type figure who might end up kind of operating in that sense in the home. But they don't have the same, it's a different kind of relationship than what the one you have to your boss, definitely. And, you know, for a lot of people, I think the work they do to reproduce themselves is at least sort of self-organized, that you decide like, how much does cleaning the dishes matter to me? How often am I going to like, you know, sweep the floors? What level am I going to sort of do some of these tasks to? So, there is some measure of autonomy, but I don't think we should then mistake that for being like, this is a realm of freedom, because it's certainly not. And it's also one that I think is really not outside of capitalism at all, because the things that, you know, both are kind of left in this kind of unwaged space, you know, that's kind of itself a product of the overall organization of our society by capitalism. And so, you know, what ends up being the kind of remainder of the household tasks or reproductive tasks, I think, is something that's kind of a product of capitalism. And then, you know, some of those things may end up being drawn in, like we're seeing the kind of experiments with things like care bots and things like that to make some of these activities more productive. So, you know, I wouldn't say that any of them are like inherently just sort of non-commodifiable, or again, some of these kind of romantic ideas that they're morally superior in some way, but rather that we need to recognize that capital is not likely to value these activities in the way we think it should. And actually, I think that reproductive labor can be a very helpful site for recognizing what I was describing before, this kind of gap between the value that a given activity has to us socially, or in terms of things like use, or what we think, how important we think it is, and how it is valued in terms of exchange value or value by capitalism. Because, you know, people are often looking at this work and they say, how can it be that these are some of the most important jobs we have, the most important work we do, to, you know, care for our children and our elders and you know, people who need assistance in various ways. These things are vitally important, and yet they are often paid very poorly or not paid at all. Like, what is going on there? And I think understanding that that's this reflection of the broader dynamics of capital investment and accumulation, and how capital ends up valuing labor according to those metrics, is really important for recognizing that we shouldn't expect those ever to change.
I'm Sasha Lilly. This is Against the Grain, and I'm speaking with Alyssa Battistoni, political theorist and author of Free Gifts, Capitalism, and the Politics of Nature. So, Alyssa, in Free Gifts, beyond what we've just discussed, the realm of the household, the realm of the factory, you also look at the realm of the biosphere, how plants and animals regenerate the biosphere so it's habitable for all of us. Can you just remind us what kind of processes regenerate our world and what it shows about the limits of putting a price on nature?
Yeah, the biosphere is really just everything in our world that kind of makes it habitable. So we can think of this as the kinds of non-human activities that are going into that are really kind of it's a bit overwhelming to think about sometimes, because, you know, we think a lot these days about carbon sequestration and kind of maintaining this balance of carbon and other elements in the atmosphere that keeps the planet at sort of a stable temperature. But there are also so many other processes of cycling nutrients through the soil or through the oceans that make possible the regeneration of life in those spaces, filtering water, the ways that different like ecosystems absorb water if there's a big storm or a hurricane or a rainstorm or something like that, and prevent massive flooding. The ways that, you know, even flooding can kind of be a way of restoring and renewing nutrients to soil. But really just like there's so many processes that are just happening every day that are comprised of so many very complex relationships between plants and animals and physical elements, you know, like chemical processes and minerals and nutrients and all these sorts of things that are very, very complex and that have made life on Earth possible in a very fundamental sense. It's sort of these activities of life itself that generate an atmosphere, that generate oceans, that make the Earth a habitable planet as opposed to like Mars or Venus or one of these other planets where we can't go and breathe. So on a pretty fundamental level, you know, the biosphere encompasses so many kinds of non-human activity and so many, gifts of nature. And most of them are not priced or valued at all. Most of, I think, what happens on our planet is actually not commodified, it's not priced, it's not valued economically in these terms that capitalism can see. And that has been a problem when that's the only form of value that things really have that registers. So there have been, these longstanding debates and arguments about whether what are sometimes called ecosystem services or forms of natural capital should be priced and valued, if should put a price on them so that they can be recognized in markets and in decision making and so on, or whether that would be to like morally degrade them, if it is morally problematic to put a price on a whale or on the ocean or these different kinds of things that are not already commodified. But I think that this is sort of a lot of these debates about the morality of pricing nature have missed the point a little bit, because in fact, there have been efforts to put a price on nature for decades now. Every 10 years or so, there's a wave of venture capitalists who go out and say they're going to kind of capture the wealth of nature. There's all of this bounty of nature out there waiting to be tapped. We're going to kind of create new markets and biodiversity credits or make nature into an asset class or whatever it may be. And each time it ends up failing. And I think that's likely to continue. And one of the problems is that they just are very difficult to, again, these processes and relationships are really difficult to commodify for a number of reasons, but largely because they are so complex, they involve these relationships amongst different kinds of beings spread across time and space. They aren't sort of something you can just kind of like put a fence around and say, okay, that's my property. They might be, if you have carbon that's circulating in the air, it's hard to say, well, this is my unit of carbon. If you think about pollinators, there's been a lot of anxiety about the status of pollinators, and with good reason. But it's interesting because, honeybees are actually, their populations have really suffered, but they're also not in danger really of extinction because they are a domesticated species. They are owned and people will hire out their bees for pollination services. And so you can pay someone to bring their bees to you. But when we think about wild pollinators, that's the real problem because, wild pollinators, nobody owns them. Nobody can like kind of make them show up to pollinate a crop or to pollinate the forest that is not producing crops directly, but that's absorbing the carbon or that's producing some other kinds of food that, other animals are eating or whatever it may be. And so it's the sort of disappearance of these kinds of nature that aren't owned, that aren't commodified, that aren't being bought and sold and paid for, that ends up being kind of eroded and disappearing in ways and being destroyed, but they're not being commodified for the most part. And it's very difficult to commodify them. You can't just kind of go out there and say, like, I own this wild butterfly. It's just at present not possible. And so there have been, efforts to kind of represent all of these in terms of like financial instruments. But again, it's a really laborious process. It's really challenging to make these like complicated elements of the natural world that are, again, happening on their own terms and on their own patterns and their own rhythms and have not been kind of rationalized and controlled in the manner of something like livestock, to make those into viable and sellable units in the way that they would need to be.
Well, Alyssa, I'd like to end by asking you about how this larger discussion of how capitalism in a sense fails to put a price, despite its drive to put a price on everything, to put a price on much of nature, and that nature then operates as this gift that of course is being depleted, destroyed. And of course there's a widespread assumption, including amongst quite a few environmentalists, that it is in our nature, that is the nature of humans, to dominate and despoil the rest of nature. And so I wanted to ask you how you see what you've been discussing in this hour, this relationship of capitalism to nature, which of course includes us, but also includes, the rest of the world beyond us, how that affects not just our relationship to nature, but how free we actually are as humans.
Yeah, I think you're right with this idea that we're just sort of driven to dominate nature is pretty widespread in a lot of environmental circles. And I really want to refute that. You know, one of the things I want to say about that treating nature as a free gift is sort of a capitalist social form that we have to understand this sort of free gift as the way that capitalism treats nature and forces us all to treat nature, is that this isn't the only way that we could relate to the more than human world to sort of, you know, say this is a specific relationship that's specific to a particular form of society and economic organization. It's not just how human beings are always going to treat non-humans in the non-human world. So I want to sort of just start by saying we have to be specific about this and not kind of essentialize that. But I also want to argue that I think one of the things that is really fundamentally the problem with capitalism is it makes it, you know, it prevents us from being able to treat nature as anything other than a free gift. We're all sort of compelled in the system to treat nature as a free gift, you know, in our everyday lives. I think, you know, when you go out and you sort of buy something, you're often sort of implicitly, you know, enacting this relationship where nature isn't valued. You're not recognizing its value because it's not reflected in the exchange value of the good. And so we're kind of constantly in all of our everyday lives just like replicating this relationship, even when we would like to do something otherwise. And I think there's something about how we're compelled to act under capitalism that really doesn't matter whether you have ecological consciousness or you want to be more sustainable or you have the right perspective. I think we inevitably end up kind of participating in and replicating the system all the time, even when we're really trying not to. So I want to say, you know, I think capitalism makes us deeply unfree and unfree in how we choose to relate to the more than human world. And I think that's partly why people feel so like them, you know, kind of overwhelmed and helpless sometimes. You know, you look around and you say, well, I don't want to be doing this. I think it's horrible what we're doing to the nature, to the environment. I don't want to participate in this, but it seems impossible to stop. And there's this way that we're all caught up in the system that is beyond our control that I think blocks us from really enacting these other kinds of relationships that I think many people genuinely do want to have to the more than human world.
Alyssa, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Alyssa Battistoni is a political theorist, author of Free Gifts, Capitalism and the Politics of Nature. She's also a co-author of A Planet to Win, Why We Need a Green New Deal. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening. And please tune in again next time.